The stewardess said both pilots.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
I've been in this town so long that back in the city I've been taken for lost and gone and unknown for a long, long time. Fell in love years ago with an innocent girl from the Spanish and Indian home, home of the heroes and villains. Once at night, Cotillion Square came by and she was riding in the rain of the bullets that eventually brought her down. Afraid of what it do in a town full of heroes and
listening to Heroes and Villains by the Beach Boys off of their Smile album, and welcome to Stuff We've Heard. I'm sorry, wrong show. This is Stuff We've Seen, and I'm your host, Jim. And now, here he is, the professional pet groomer for the president's lapdogs, Dill. How's it going, buddy?
Oh, man, there's just so much to unpack in there.
Yeah, well, maybe that's a different show.
Because I could talk about Smile for a while.
Oh, yes. Stuff We've Heard. I know now you've actually given me an idea. I feel like I could definitely talk about things I've heard, stuff I've heard. I love music as much as I love movies. So
yeah, so there would potentially be something there.
Yes.
A whole new show for us.
We're going to get right on that because, you know, it's so easy to get this show taped. So, okay. So listen, I want to, a couple of things, you know, we're almost to the end of the year and, you know, as it every year you have a lot of celebrity passings, right?
Uh-huh.
And we talk.
Are you setting us up for this little moment at the Oscars where they show who
died? In memoriam? No, I'm not.
The in memoriam?
No, but just a couple of passings that passed us by that we didn't mention, and I feel like we should mention them. Well, one of them was on the episode that got lost. We call it the lost episode, and that and that was Albert Finney, and we had a lot to say about that. But
yeah,
and so that kind of passed. Maybe we'll get back to him in a few weeks. But you know, he was somebody that, you know, was big for me. So he passed, and we didn't get to really talk about him on a show that you heard. And
right.
But then there's a couple of others that passed away that I can't believe we didn't mention. One was recent, was Robert Forster.
Yes,
and I mean he was so great in Jackie Brown, but he was also really great in a movie that I love, Medium Cool.
Me too. One of my all-time favorite movies.
And it's one of my all-time favorites. So, you know, he's great. And, you know, I salute you, Robert Forster. And then there's a guy that passed away this year. And you and I both knew him in a way. We didn't really know him, but was Seymour Cassell.
Yeah, I knew him.
Character actor. And the two of us knew him because we worked on a movie in the early 90s, an independent film called In the Soup.
Yes. And he was the star of that along with Steve Buscemi.
That's correct. And, you know, you were an assistant to the director, Alex Rockwell.
Yeah.
And I was an intern when I was at NYU. You kind of conned me into that. I could have done an internship at Saturday Night Live or something else. And you're like, no, how about this? Oh, the good times.
Good times. Yeah. That was it was an experience.
And you had been telling me about Seymour Cassell for months before that, right? Because you had met this guy, and I didn't really know him too well at the time, but he was a real feisty character.
Yes, definitely a character.
And I got to meet him in person because he had arrived in town to start rehearsals for the movie, and he was staying at the apartment of Harvey Keitel.
That's right.
And Was it Lorraine Bracco?
Lorraine Bracco, yeah.
They were married at the time. I don't think they're married anymore. And they were not there. They were away. But so basically Seymour was going to be crashing there for the duration of the film. And a script, which there were many versions of that film. There was like a script every day, I felt.
There was, yeah.
Well,
written by different people.
Yeah, I mean, it went through a lot of – well, again, but that was what the interesting thing was when, you know, you wonder how does a film become a film and it starts with a script. But if you work on a film, you see all of the different changes and all of the drama and everything it takes to get this thing to the end.
And then it all changes in editing.
And then it all changes in editing because I didn't get this – I wasn't there for the whole shoot. I was only there for a few weeks and then school ended because it was supposed to shoot earlier. And that's a whole long story that it got shut down and it came back. But I remember because I was very familiar with the script by the time it was all over that I got to see it for a screening of cast and crew. And it was only because I bumped into that producer, Hank, on the street.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, how random is that? I bump into the guy the day of and he's like, oh, well, you should come to the screen tonight. But when I saw the movie, I was like, this isn't a film we shot. Where's all the content?
Yeah, it ended up it all changed in editing, especially on that film. There was major changes.
Yeah, but we're not here to talk about that. I wanted to tell you just that how I met him was I had to bring Seymour Cassell over to that apartment, a copy of the script, and then I was kind of hijacked by the guy for a good hour.
Oh, that does not surprise me at all. That's his personality. He would hijack you, and he was very charismatic and funny, and could sort of the way that sometimes charismatic people can do is where they turn their attention on you, and you feel great because of it.
Yeah. I don't think he would do too well in today's environment, but
no, I think that
his kind of charisma is a little bit to be desired.
It was old school charisma.
Yes. Yes. He was definitely like a raconteur and
I think that of his movies, Minnie and Moskowitz is the one that I think captures him the most.
Right. It was essentially, him. Cassavetes was a good friend of his, and he was basically getting to do a version of him.
Yes, and it is sort of a version of Seymour. So, if you want to catch what he was like in real life, that's probably the closest you can get.
Yeah, but, you knew him way more than I did, but I just can't believe, he passed away, and we actually were people that could talk about it in a way that we actually knew who he was.
And somehow we missed it.
Yep. So sorry about that. And now a second one. All right. I'm going into this direction. Another. This to me is a legend. And I was hoping that you will want to share just a little bit because I think that it's fascinating. But one of the greatest modern film has only been around for like 100 plus years, but probably of, I'd say, the 20th century, sort of the godfather of the verite cinema movement was the great late documentary director D.A. Pennebaker.
Yes.
And this is the reason, and I can't believe we didn't talk about it at the time.
He was in his 90s, huh?
Yeah, he lived a long time.
Because he was old when I knew him.
Well, okay, see, you just jumped it. I met him, but you knew him.
Yes, I worked for him, actually.
Yeah. Now, I was just hoping you could maybe mention that a little bit, if you don't mind.
Well, I could go on for quite a while on this, and I don't know if we want to, but I'll just say, I worked on, I was an editing assistant on his Depeche Mode movie.
101.
If people don't know his other movies, probably his most famous movie is Don't Look Back with Bob Dylan.
And Monterey Pop.
But he basically made a verite music documentaries and was, I could go on.
Well, Ziggy Stardust,
yeah. One thing I remember about him, I remember many things, but he had been offered some narrative films in the 70s. Like, he was offered to direct, I think, one of the Woody Allen movies.
Like Play It Again, Sam, or something?
Exactly, yeah. And so he was offered some narrative films early in his career, and he said, He said, I just never wanted to do it because to me it would be like choreographing a baseball game.
Right. He likes the spontaneity.
He liked not knowing what was going to happen. And, you know, we were just talking about how it all changes in editing. Well, you know, he would shoot 100 hours on something and then the film is really made in the editing, but you don't know what you're going to get. And so it's this very sort of improvisational, almost jazz-like approach to it.
You just said the word jazz. And so my introduction, other than, you know, seeing some of his films, when I knew you, when I was going to NYU, yeah. And we had a brief year that we lived together.
Yes.
You sat me down and said, I want to show you something.
Oh, yes.
I want to show you a video. And you popped in this little, 4 or 5 minutes?
Yeah, it's about five or six minutes maybe, yeah.
It's D.A. Pennebaker's first film effort called Daybreak Express.
Yes.
And I sat down. I honestly did not know about the movie. I knew nothing about it. And I watched this. And honestly, it changed my opinion of film.
Wow.
Watching that moment, and I don't think you could really even understand right. when I saw that, what was going on inside me, but it was like this opening of a door. And when we talk about that expression, pure cinema,
yes. there's
nothing purer that I can think of pure cinema than the magic of that 5 minute movie.
It magic is absolutely right. It's, you know, it's for the people who haven't seen it, it's shots of trains around New York largely. He rode around on trains for a few days, just shooting anything that he thought was interesting. And then he went to cut it together and he had a little hand reel editing machine. And so as he was cutting it, he would play this Duke Ellington record sort of along with it as he was doing it. And he finally decided, oh, I do want to put this Duke Ellington music on here. So he took a bus to Duke Ellington's office.
This is amazing.
And he walked in and he basically said, can I use your song? And Duke Ellington said, well, let me see what you got. And he showed him the movie and he said, yeah, absolutely. You can have my song.
That's how it was done back in those days.
Yes. but it's a really amazing little 5 minutes. I remember reading about Robert Flaherty seeing that film for the first time. Robert Flaherty, who made Nanook of the North.
Yes.
And he was quite old, but he saw Daybreak Express, and I think he had a similar reaction to what you did. He just, what is this? I've never seen anything like it. Who is this Pennebaker person? How was this film, you know, how did this come out of somebody's... just a couple of days on trains. The shots in it are just amazing, and the way he makes them work with the movement and the music and the color. It's an early music video, I guess, but it's still so much better than most music videos.
Well, what's so cool about it is the means of film available to D.A. Pennebaker as just like a home movie maker was an 8mm camera that had 3 different lenses on it and a filter kit.
Yes.
And then Kodachrome 8mm film. And the colors and the saturation and the deep blacks and of the color of that film, it's just outstanding.
It's absolutely, yeah.
And it's also, because of the trains, it's riding on tracks that don't exist anymore.
Oh, yeah. You see the city in a way. Yeah, because they were elevated trains at the time before a lot of the subway lines were put in.
I think it's been imitated many times, but it's something that sits on the film registry. And I think if you have a Criterion channel, you can see it. It's really fantastic.
I was just going to say, is it available anywhere? But
yeah. Oh, yeah. I saw it when Filmstruck was still available. That was one of the first things I watched.
Oh.
I was like, oh, I bet you they have it. And they did. And Criterion has it. So.
Okay. Well, go check it out then. I should watch it again. I mean, I've seen it so many times, but it would be great to see it again. Show it to my kids.
You should. You should absolutely. And, you know, again, I met him because you took me to his apartment.
Yes.
And we had like a lunch. Not really a lunch, but what are those like, it's the vegetable that you eat where you peel off the different leaves.
artichoke?
Yes. He served us artichokes.
That's right.
And then told us stories. And so and I never forgot that.
Yeah, he was great at telling stories. And of course, he had just met tons of famous people, many of whom he had filmed. He made a series of short films with Jack Kennedy, actually.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. He made a short film of Timothy Leary's wedding.
That'd be fascinating to see.
It's about 30 minutes long. So there's all these little treasures that he made along the way that didn't get the big notice of the music movies. But he was just sort of constantly making things. Oh, I guess one of his, it's not recent now, but War Room with James Carville and George Stephanopoulos.
Now, have you ever seen the show Documentary Now?
I have not. I know of it. I know what it's about.
Well, you should, because there's a couple of his movies, and I'm saying his is D.A. Pounderbaker's movies, right, that they spoof.
Oh, there's more than one.
Yeah, there's The War Room, and then D.A. Pounderbaker did this famous recording of the studio album for like one of Stephen Sondheim's musicals.
Yes.
And they did, in the last season of Documentary Now, they did the most brilliant spoof of that.
Oh, wow.
It's so good. It's like a half hour. And what they do on Documentary Now is great, is they not only just say, okay, this film that from a documentary filmmaker that we want to spoof, kind of maybe that storyline.
Right.
They actually spoof the camera techniques used.
Right.
And the lighting. And then so if you had a film that, say, was like 16 millimeter, they will shoot it on 16 millimeter with the same types of cameras.
Oh, they actually go that far, huh?
It goes to the max on that show.
Oh, I didn't realize that they were that dedicated about the look of it. I thought they were just throwing some filters in post.
It's the greatest show. There was one instead they did a spoof on Salesmen, and it was Globesmen. And it was guys that walked around. They were selling globes. This show is so great. But anyways, those were just a few of the people that passed away this year that I wanted to mention, because we never did. And it's just weird that we had some kind of connection to two of those.
Yeah. Yeah, I could go. Maybe at some point in the future, we'll look at a Pennebaker film specifically. But
yeah, this was just a reminder episode to say, well, I just didn't know if you're like, shy. I mean, again, you're a modest guy, and you don't really go, hey, I knew this person or that person.
Right.
And because that's not really what this show is about, but you did know those people. So
no, that's a different show called People We've Met.
Look for it soon. Okay, so. Last we checked on the episode, I had seen The Irishman in the theater, and yes, you were maybe going to watch it over the Thanksgiving holiday. So,
yes.
Did you?
And I did. I ended up watching The Irishman. I was a little unsure at first. I thought, okay, I'll just give it a try, right? It was kind of late, and I thought, well, I'll just give it like a half an hour and see what it's like, and I'll finish it up tomorrow. I ended up watching 2.5 hours of it, and then I actually did fall asleep and had to finish it the next day. But I got so sucked into it really pretty quickly, and I think, I was a little thrown off by the de-aging at first. I got used to it over the course of the film, but it's like you had said, we know what 40-year-old Robert De Niro looks like, and he doesn't look like that guy.
Right.
And, I was thinking, well, if somebody who doesn't really know what Robert De Niro looks like watches this film, will they, or people who aren't really into these actors, like, for instance, if my kids have no idea who Al Pacino is.
Right.
But, I wouldn't necessarily show my kids this film, but if I did, would they look at the de-aging technology differently than I do, knowing what these people look like? And I think they probably would. I think it would be more effective.
Like, would they even notice that it was de-aging, or they just, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
It's... Exactly. I think they would just, I don't think they would even notice. I think it was really well done. But yeah, like I said, I got really sucked into this movie. And for a number of reasons, there was... Top reason, of course, is De Niro's performance is incredible. And it's an epic performance, and it really doesn't, how good it is doesn't really hit you until the last hour of the movie.
That's it. That's when I remember when I told you, I said it makes a change. It wasn't like there's a change that happens in Goodfellas, which really got me. It was that it completely changed gears. It became this coke-fueled day of Ray Liotta where it all went down. And I thought that was the moment when I was like, this movie is a masterstroke. Well, it wasn't a coke-filled moment in this, but it changes to something so profound.
And it's the exact opposite of coke-filled. It's really quiet. There's very little dialogue in it. There's a lot of his face and his realization of what's happening. And he does so much internally in sort of that half-hour sequence that just comes across so strongly in his performance, his ambivalence about what he's doing and his loyalty, all these different issues that we've seen throughout the film sort of come to a head in his performance. And then that last half hour is like a 30-minute denouement where that most movies would do in 3 or 4 minutes.
Oh, you know what I love? And again, look, if nobody wants to know anything about The Irishman, then stop and go away. I mean, but yeah. And I feel like this is how some movies, the thrill is like not knowing the spoilers. In a film like this, I don't know if it's like you could find out everything about it and then still sit down and enjoy it.
Well, because also it is a true story. So
yeah, that's the whole thing. It's like, well, if you don't know anything about Jimmy Hoffa, maybe you'll be surprised. But right. Otherwise, you know, you got to think that it's not going to be Tarantino directing this movie where Jimmy Hoffa has a surprise for the mob. But the scene that really, there's a few scenes, but one that at the end that you're talking about, and I just thought it was an amazing scene, was when De Niro visits the salesman for the caskets.
Yes.
And that guy was so callous and obnoxious. Yeah. And he doesn't realize that the guy is going to buy a casket for himself.
Right. Yeah. He's there casket shopping. Yeah. That.
It's all those things, you know, his
right. But it's a simple thing, but it ends up being a really profound scene.
Yeah. Well, why I think it's so great is that what he basically is, you know, kind of saying is that most of the guys that he knew, they don't get a chance to do that step.
Yes.
You don't get to pick your own moment of death kind of thing or like prepare it, because he's already seen how too many times these characters, and some of these people, I mean, some of them were his buddies that he ends up killing, you know, like throughout the movie, but they don't know when it's coming.
They have no idea. Well, and this was another thing I was thinking is I really liked the violence in this movie.
It's very violent like Scorsese does, but it's something very different in that it's matter of fact kind of thing.
It's very matter of fact. There's a few scenes where he shoots somebody by basically just walking up to them on the street, pops him twice in the head and walks away. And there's not an exploding head. There's not a bunch of blood. It's not amped up. It's done very matter-of-factly and very, it's almost perfunctory. Just bam, bam, walk away. It's not drawn out. It's not trying to get this tension. I think it's in keeping with this character who is kind of matter-of-fact about painting houses, as they call it.
Well, you know, there's that. So even at the scenes that are, do you have that dramatic buildup? There's a moment towards the beginning. It has a very sort of Goodfellas / Casino vibe, has the great sort of instrumental song, which is called Perfidio.
Yes.
And it's showing a mob hit. But then, and it's got all that great buildup and you're expecting this moment. But then the camera goes down the hallway and it happens off screen.
Yes.
And you see the aftermath. And it's just these little strokes that you continually through this movie remind you that you're in the hands of one of the great filmmakers of all time. And he continues to make films that have his style, but also go into different directions that he hasn't gone in before.
Well, exactly. And I feel like this was one of his more mature works. Maybe that's the wrong way to put it. But in some of his earlier films, there were moments of high style. I feel like Goodfellas has a lot of, you know, that fast camera. It's very highly stylized. And this seemed a little bit just calmer. somehow. I mean, of course, part of that is that Goodfellas is a Coke-fueled binge, right? But even if you look at something like After Hours, there's very stylized camera work. There's fancy camera work. And there was not, this film was, The Irishman was much more subtle in terms of its visual approach. And like you said, there's those masterful moments, but they're less obvious, that you don't look at it and go, wow, that's a cool shot. It affects you on a deeper level somehow. And I felt like this film was really consistent in its visual style and in its approach in a way that gave the actors a lot of room to breathe, and they need it. But, you know, even though, like, Pacino is going to choose scenery no matter what, they actually, Scorsese managed to get some more subtle moments out of Pacino. But the movie has a lot of subtlety, and I think that's, I don't know, it's something I really appreciated.
One of the things that I read that Scorsese and I think it's Rodrigo Prieto?
I believe so.
His cinematographer, and they worked in several movies together, that they worked this out very specifically. They didn't want a widescreen movie. They wanted the shots to feel that very matter-of-fact, not as dramatic.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, actually, is that matter-of-fact approach.
Well, so it's weird because you see this 3.5-hour film, and it goes by very fast, but it doesn't have that sweeping 3.5-hour, like, sort of gangster saga feel. It feels like this intimate movie that...
That's a really good way to... Well, and it is largely made up of scenes between two people. And there aren't a lot of the, you know, there's not a lot of those big sweeping, you know, there's that one shot where they're pushing taxi cabs into the, you know, but there's not a lot of big set pieces. It's a lot of two people in a small room or at a table talking to each other. And I got to mention this before I forget, is at the end credits, Steve Zaillian's name came up.
And you didn't know he was the screenwriter?
I didn't know he was the writer until the end. And when his name came up, it was sort of like, oh, that explains a lot.
Well, yeah, because he's a matter-of-fact screenwriter. It's not flashy, like, oh, we're going to have, you know, I mean, well, no, I was going to say I don't have, like, as many of those great dialogue lines that I'll be remembering and saying. But, of course, there is this thing, and I've been already using it. It's when, you know, when the mobsters... When they're having a problem with a guy, they say, you know, I'm a little bit concerned. But what they really mean is, well, I'm a little bit more than a little bit concerned. I'm a lot concerned. And then that's when you know that it's time for someone to go.
So it reminded me of another Steve Zaillian movie that I hated.
Oh, well, which one was that?
It's called American Gangster.
Did he write that? I think it was our good old friend Ridley Scott there that botched that one up.
Yeah, Ridley Scott botched that one, but it was reminiscent of that script, and I actually thought about that movie once or twice while I was watching this, and like how wrong that movie went.
That's too bad, because that's actually a really good story. I've seen the documentary, and the documentary is way more entertaining than the film was.
Yeah, total failure of a movie.
But did you see, I think Steven Zaillian was involved heavily in it, was that HBO miniseries, The Night Of, I think?
Oh, yes, that he wrote that.
Did you see it?
No, I didn't see it.
It's an incredible piece of, filmmaking, TV making. It is so good. And then, again, the writing, you get Richard Price and Zaillian together.
Yeah, that's a pretty good combo. Yeah, but Zaillian, he also did Gangs of New York, which is a much more sort of highly stylized.
No, I think that was Kenneth Lonergan.
I think it was both of them.
Oh, they both worked on it? I thought it was because it started with Lonergan, right?
It started with Lonergan, but Zaillian has credit.
He does.
Yes. Along with Jay Cox, Steve Zaillian, and Kenneth Lonergan.
Oh, Jay Cox, right.
Yeah.
And there's a movie I think that both of us liked that a lot of people didn't.
I love Gangs of New York, yeah. But that's actually a good example of like the loud Scorsese. the visual voice is much more present and loud in that movie.
Well, he does have that larger-than-life character, Bill the Butcher.
Exactly. But it's more heavily visually stylized than The Irishman. And, it's tough. I really was looking for things to criticize in The Irishman, and I couldn't come up with much. So maybe that makes it boring to talk about.
The way I look at it is, When this movie was over, I felt that if I never got another movie from Scorsese or De Niro or Pacino, I could be happy.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because it's such a great, it would be, a, it's like, you know, because we're going to pick on Spielberg, your favorite target, is that the last several movies, right, in his career, I'm just not seeing the same guy that I fell in love with as a kid. And no. With West Side Story, I haven't seen a lick of that, but it still questions this is what he's involved in. And, you know, you just aren't going to get that many more movies. So the question is, will we get another, you know, will we get a masterpiece out of Spielberg again? And I'm not sure. Where Scorsese, this guy in the last years, I was not a big Departed fan, but it's a good movie.
It's a good movie. Yeah. I actually like the original better.
But I also loved Hugo. And then out of nowhere, he comes up with Wolf of Wall Street. And I thought that was fantastic. And then this movie, it's like this guy just doesn't stop with his masterpieces, because this is a masterpiece, I think.
This is a masterpiece. And it's interesting because some of those movies you were just mentioning is, you know, Scorsese's always sort of done, you know, sort of a studio movie and maybe something a little more personal like Kundun or Silence.
And I didn't see Silence. I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet either. But, you know, those are sort of his more personal films. And then he does these sort of studio blockbusters like The Aviator.
Yeah, which is really like not very studio blockbustery if you watch it.
No, it isn't. But it's more marketable than something like Silence.
Yeah, which hardly got a release. And like I said, I don't know why I'm avoiding it, but it just feels like, you know. But I saw Kundun in the theater at the time. And I always think of that scene in Sopranos with Chris Maltasanti. And he goes, Marty, Kundun, I liked it.
Marty, Kundun, I liked it.
It's just the best. But, you know, it's so funny because, you know, we mentioned Goodfellas a little earlier, but a little D.A. Pennebaker tie-in. When we saw Goodfellas, we were, again, living together at that year when it came out.
Yeah.
And first of all, we were all excited, right, to go see this movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
We go the opening afternoon, like I was out of school for the afternoon ever, we go to the theater, we're all pumped up, and we get there and discover that the movie doesn't even come out for a week. It was such a letdown. And so we ended up, like, our best second bet was to see that movie State of Grace with...
Oh, the Phil Juano movie.
Yeah, with Sean Penn.
Yeah, the Irish gang movie.
It was sort of based on the Westies, I think, was the book.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was that bad, but we had to make the most of it. And it was like a scene in the film where the two of them were like always challenging each other to like a 30-yard dash or whatever.
That's right.
And after that movie and for several weeks afterwards, whenever we got to a crosswalk, the two of us would race and say, we'd look at each other and somebody go, 30-yard dash or whatever it was.
That's right.
But then a week later, when it came out, we went to see it. And we took along a friend of yours, which was D.A. Pennebaker's daughter.
That's right. Yep.
She came and saw the movie with us, but we got there and it was like a 10 o'clock show. It was sold out.
Yeah.
So we had to go to the midnight show, and we went to like a coffee shop for a while first, and then we went back and saw the movie. And for me, Goodfellas was just my favorite film of that decade, but it was that moment within the first like 5 minutes of the film. It not only hooked me, but I felt I'm watching something very special.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Right from the beginning.
Because I hadn't seen anything other. I mean, now it's hard. I'll watch Goodfellas or drop in on it from time to time when it's on TV. But there's just nothing like a first time seeing it where nobody's told you anything about it. There's been no spoilers and you just go in cold, and it did things that no film had done at the time. That's the editing techniques.
The editing techniques are totally mind blowing and, boy, imitated like crazy for the rest of that decade.
And, you know, going back to The Irishman, right, and again, this is like Scorsese's long-time relationship with his editor, Thelma Schumacher.
Yeah.
There's definitely these techniques that she's used in Casino and Goodfellas, mm-hmm. and they're used again here, but just a little differently. And they're not necessary, right? You could going through a pan through a room of gangsters and not have to like say anything about them. But this movie takes pains to focus in on a gangster and then freeze frame it and then show you that this person died, how they died, and the year and the date that they died.
I love that. It pauses on someone and it says like shot four times in the head, May 3rd, 1980.
Well, didn't you notice that's the cumulative effect is there must have been some kind of gang war happening because between like 80 to 84, a lot of these characters are killed.
Exactly. Yeah, there was some major thing was going on in gangland in the early 80s, right around the Hoffa disappearance.
Hoffa was 76.
That's right. Yeah. So it was soon after that. Yeah.
But, you know, that was another thing is that, the Hoffa, and again, no spoilers here, Hoffa disappeared in real life and was never seen again. This offers a potential way, if you want to believe the real life Frank Sheeran's story, that he was involved.
Yeah.
But in the movie, what's so kind of poignant is, you know, De Niro's character has seen it all and knows when a character, he's trying to kind of get Hoffa off of, you know, getting on the naughty list, but Hoffa's got a too big an ego. And so I think, and then this is the question, because it's a little ambiguous, but when he goes on this road trip, right, which is sort of the bookends kind of thing of the film, I think that, you know, they know this Hoffa meeting. I'm pretty sure he knows that Hoffa's not going to come out of that meeting, but what he doesn't know is that he has to be involved.
Exactly. And that slowly dawns on him.
Well, because I think what he also, why it's that slow dread is that he knows it makes sense because Hoffa isn't going to get into the car or go to a meeting if he's not there. So by virtue of the fact they need him, and it seems almost kind of like this weird, cruel thing that Joe Pesci's character, you know, has over him. Sort of the loyalty is that there really wasn't any reason why De Niro had to be the one. But yet it's because Pesci wanted it to be.
Well, he's also sort of demonstrating his loyalty to
Pesci. Well,
that's
what I'm saying, the loyalty thing. And then, you know, I rewatched the first hour of the film because my wife wanted to see it. And we just haven't gotten back to it because we're busy. But what I noticed right off in the first shots, things that just kind of flew by me the first time, is at the beginning, De Niro's laying out all these clothes for the trip. He puts on the ring. The loyalty ring. And that's not a moment that would mean anything at the beginning of the movie if you hadn't seen it. So when I rewatch this back, there's these little subtle details that I can concentrate on, and I'm realizing, oh, this movie's so well set up.
Yeah, okay, that's really, and it's, but again, it's done in this very subtle, matter-of-fact way. It's, you know, a younger Scorsese may have done like a zoom in on the ring.
Well, that's the thing is, he already knows, he is such a master, he knows how to put things together in a certain way. It was all important, and, you know, I don't know if you know about this controversy that's crept up, and it's just idiotic, but people have had issues with the fact that Anna Paquin plays the adult version of De Niro's daughter and that she only has like one line. And I mean, I didn't know we were going in for an Anna Paquin film. What they don't understand is that she was likely offered this role and they're like, you know, this is an important role and it really only has a line, but it's a very key line. And it's like, I'm going to be in a Scorsese movie. Sure. And I think people think, well, when you have an A-list kind of name that you're going to only sign up if you have an A-list long part.
Right. But no.
And because he uses all these other actresses that you may not know their names, maybe she stands out and people are like, I don't understand. Why does she have not a role? But I think that's a dumb thing. It's just,
I think that's totally dumb.
First of all, she looks like the younger daughter.
Well, she looks like the younger daughter, but also it's such an important part that she's playing. It's like it's the whole emotional center of the last half hour of the movie.
Yes. And if you've been watching the whole movie and you see that the way that the younger daughter observes and looks and figures out exactly what her father is and the business he's in.
Exactly.
She carries it through and you really believe that she's the grown up version of that little girl.
Right. And you have to believe that. But for the emotional weight of that to work, you need somebody really good in delivering that one line.
So, you know, I don't have a problem with that. And
so that's a controversy. Okay,
it is. I mean, it's a stupid one, but
it's different than the controversy I was going to go for. But
Well, before you, I want to put a pin in that one. What he does do, though, and this was so great, and I'm talking Scorsese, is he casts as Hoffa's wife Lois Bird, who was the babysitter in Goodfellas that was I was so excited. That was Ray Liotta's babysitter, Lois Bird, coming out of a acting retirement, if you will, and she plays off his wife. And she actually got a sizable role, and I thought that was pretty cool.
That is cool. Yeah, okay.
So now what was the controversy you were going to say?
I saw like a Facebook post or something, and it said something like, if you want to annoy your husband, pretend you don't know who Joe Pesci, Robert De Niro, and Al Pacino are.
That's a controversy?
Well, so what it got me thinking was that this is a very male movie.
Oh, okay. I gotcha.
Right. And in general, I think Scorsese tends to be very male in general. You know, Goodfellas is a very male film. I can't think of a Scorsese film that's really about women.
Age Innocence a little bit, maybe?
That might be the closest, yeah.
Alice doesn't live here anymore.
Okay, yeah, good point. Yeah, and I mean, it's not a slam against Scorsese.
Boxcar Bertha.
Did you ever hear this story about...
That's going to launch you into a story. Barbara Hershey time.
Okay, so he made Boxcar Bertha, and he showed it at a screening, like an industry screening, right? And John Cassavetes was at it. And Scorsese goes up to him afterwards and says, hey, what'd you think? And Cassavetes goes, it's a piece of shit. And Scorsese's like, what? Cassavetes goes, yeah, it's a piece of shit. Get out of here. Go back to New York and make the movie you want to make, because this isn't it.
And then he followed up with Mean Streets.
But he actually took that to heart. He was really, I think Cassavetes actually had a big impact on him in that moment, where he had to decide whether he was going to, you know, follow his own artistic path or whether he was going to go more Hollywood route. And I think, yeah, that was sort of a moment. I don't know. I read that in an interview with Scorsese at one point or something. But, you know, I'm not sure. I guess I could ask you what your wife thinks of the movie so far. But I think I think men like this movie more than women do.
I have no evidence either way to support that. I don't know. My wife, I mean, she hasn't been saying, oh, we got to get back to watching that.
Right.
But I think it's just been, you know, we've been very busy and she probably wants to give it her full concentration. And it's funny, you're an hour in and yet you still have 2+ hours left.
Yeah. It the way time works in the movie is really interesting, though, because it doesn't feel like it's filled with tension at every moment or intense plot that's pulling you through. You're sort of pulled through by the performances, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, let's face it, De Niro, that's the thing is, I don't want to say I've written him off, but the guy took so many paycheck roles that you've kind of forgot how great an actor he can be.
I feel like I had written him off. You know, he just did, yes, so many paycheck roles where he was just sort of mugging for the camera and doing a De Niro impression. Yeah, I forgot he could do this, and I think he's must get a nomination for this.
Yeah, and to me, I mean, again, you could certainly, there's two supporting roles that could be nominated, Al Pacino, to me, Pesci is going to give Brad Pitt a serious run for his money in the supporting actor category, because, I mean, what Pesci does, I just think it's phenomenal. Just shows
it
you
is how,
this guy was
yeah.
such a great actor. I mean, it's almost scarier in some ways than his character in Goodfellas.
I think it is, yeah, because he's so confident and so powerful and doesn't need to assert it at all.
Yeah, it's that gentle, and I think where you see the scariness is that he wants to be loved by the children, and
right.
De Niro's daughter is totally frightened of him because she knows.
She and that scene when he gives her like $100 bill in her present,
and she doesn't want to say thank you for that.
Yeah,
yeah. These are the moments, right? That you don't have to include those moments in a movie, but when you have a film like this, it really adds up.
Well, and that's the thing about The Breathing Room. It allows you to have those little character moments that add up to something big by the end of the movie. But it's not so tied down to plot at every moment that You know, if it was, you say, okay, we'll just trim the fat, try to make it as clean and lean as possible. And it still feels pretty lean, but it does have all those moments.
Yeah. And I can understand that, you know, only Netflix would let them make this movie.
Oh, yeah. And they spent a pretty good amount of money on this thing,
a
huh?
A lot. But, here's my biggest complaint. Netflix, right? If you're going to have a prestige film, come up with like a new logo or something for the intrigue. When I saw it in the theater, it really felt like, oh, Netflix is just beaming in something onto my local theater. It didn't have that cinema feel. Even Amazon Studios has like this really kind of nice little logo. Like, come on, Netflix. You can do that logo's for Bird Box. It's not for The Irishman or Marriage Story or, you know, their prestige. That was embarrassing. You know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, yeah, Netflix does somehow. I mean, I got to say, even watching it.
They have to be smart. Like, you know, like it was like Fox Searchlight or like all these studios would come up with like a prestige label. They ought to like create a gold Netflix saying, this is going to be one of the good movies to watch.
Right. Yeah. But then they'd screw it up and try to market Bird Box to you as a prestige film.
Oh, no. Turd Box. I mean, we should do a special end of the year of like worst films we watched on Netflix this year.
Pretty much everything.
Yeah. Except for The Irishman.
Yeah. Well, if Netflix is going to continue to do one or two of these a year, I'm happy with that.
Well, now in December, I look forward to it because I got to watch The Irishman, and tonight I want to watch this Marriage Story movie, and then I want to check out this Two Popes thing in a few weeks. I mean, that's three movies, you know, and they're all possible Oscar qualifier whatevers. Okay, so there, we've talked about The Irishman, and I'm glad you enjoyed it.
We probably could keep going.
But. Well, you know, this show never is going to go all the way. So we have, you know, I don't know, we have like you know, go say 15 minutes of programming left. Do we want to talk about the Beach Boys' Smiley Smile?
I want to talk about another movie I saw that you recommended to me.
Okay, now I have no idea what you're going to say, so I'm very intrigued.
Yeah, you recommended it to me as one of the best films of this year.
Of this year? Oh, I think I know. So wait, as a little preface, there's been times where I actually spoke about this movie on the podcast, and then inevitably, because we didn't really get into it, I think probably because you hadn't seen it, we trimmed it out. So you may never have realized, you, the listener, that we ever talked about it. We did talk about it once, but I edited it out because I was like, you know what? You didn't have anything to talk about back to me on it, so it doesn't make any sense. So
right. It's just you telling me about the movie. Well, I did manage to see it, and you would, you highly recommended it. It's called The Farewell.
What's that movie? No, yeah, I know. Yes. The Awkwafina film.
The Farewell is about a young Chinese-American woman who finds out her grandmother is dying. And so the family, just incredible. The family decides to put on a wedding so that everyone can come back and say goodbye to the grandmother before she dies, and they don't tell the grandmother that she's about to die.
But keep in mind, it's a real wedding. I thought going in that it was going to be like they're faking a wedding, but no, they actually fashioned together a real wedding. And it's kind of funny because the couple that's getting married, the bride who is not related to the family, she looks a little shell-shocked.
I think she's Japanese. And,
yeah.
And so she doesn't even speak Chinese. And so she's totally shell-shocked through the whole thing. And the groom is hysterical. By the end of the movie, he's totally wasted at the wedding party.
I don't really even talk about the plot necessarily, is that my experience when I watched a film like this, I found it refreshing to see a film about different cultures, but then the clashes that these cultures have within themselves that is so different from, you know, the American experience that I know. And there was this dynamic of people that, like you said, Japanese, there's part of the family doesn't live in China anymore. And they instead of moving to, you always think of like in movies, oh, they move from China to America. But in this case, some of the family had moved to Japan.
Exactly. And had been there for 20 years. And the other part of the family's been in America for 20 years. So they haven't seen each other in a very long time. And so part of that was like seeing these two brothers come back together after years and years apart. It was really interesting, and sort of the bond and how quickly they pick up again. And they there's a lot of sort of eating and drinking and Just family coming back together, and this the main character, this young woman, I thought it was an incredible performance. She,
you mean Awkwafina's?
Yeah, and some really.
I know it's hard to say that name without laughing, but
yeah, but she did. There were some interesting choices, not just in her performance, but like in her costuming, that she sort of sticks with her American clothes and doesn't really dress up for the wedding at all. And you can see sort of her inner conflict there in these little subtle ways. But the fact of the matter is, this is, like you had said, is a movie that I think could be enjoyed pretty much by all ages.
Well, it's PG.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think my 7-year-old, I think my 7-year-old would be, she'd be bored.
No, but I'm talking like anybody 10 and up.
Yeah.
Well, because I think that, again, what I liked is this film talked about how much we are all alike, even with differences. And
yes.
So watching it too, I just, you don't see a lot of family drama movies that are also comedy. I mean, it's definitely funny.
Yeah, but, it has, it's humor, not comedy.
But take a step back, right? And this is the part that kind of blows my mind is when you think about the fact you just watch this family and you watch some of their dysfunction, but their love and all this stuff. And then you take a step back and go, wait a minute, I just watched a movie. None of these people are related to each other.
Right.
They are just actors, but I bought it for that hour and 40 minutes, nice, tight script, and it just gave me an experience that by the end, I mean, there's, I don't want to give away, but there's a scene that happens towards the end, and I definitely had some tears that I was streaming on my face.
I had a good emotional range going on with this movie. I was moved by it. I laughed at times. Yes, I almost teared up a little bit. It's a really engaging movie. I was not expecting much from it, even though you would talked about how great it was. And for some reason, I just wasn't expecting it to be quite as emotionally engaging as it actually is. I don't know if it's on my best of the year yet, but it's definitely a movie I would recommend. I'm highly recommending it to my parents.
Yeah, it catches you by surprise. I think that's what you're experiencing is that, you hear these things and then you go into it and it really isn't exactly what you thought it was going to be.
Right. It's not exactly what I thought it was. I mean, I really didn't know much about it besides you saying it was good and sort of the one sentence description. And yeah, so I had known there was a wedding and that she was dying and stuff. But then at the end of the movie, there's a little, so it's a true story.
Yeah. Well, let's you say that there's a, I think it's a, like a, it leaves you with a lot of emotions, but at the end, you have another little surprise, I would say.
Yes. I'll just leave it at that. Yeah. So I would recommend this as that people go see this holiday season with their families. I think, it's not a holiday movie. It doesn't take place at the holidays, but it's a celebratory movie and it's about family struggles and generations and how we come to terms with our own identity within our families. And it does it all with, some humor and some tears. So I highly recommend this as a family holiday movie. Go see it with your family.
Well, what I also liked in the film was they go, was it to Beijing? Is that where they were at?
Yeah,
and I believe. There's a lot about how much Beijing has changed. And so a lot of these people are this family, they're struggling with how much they have changed, how much their families have changed, but then also that the place that they remember isn't the same anymore. Like
exactly.
That nostalgia that they have for something that's different.
And that this nostalgia applies to their own family. They haven't seen each other in 20 years. And so it's this whole sort of thing about aging and memory and who you're connected to in the world and where those ties mean something.
Yeah, and then also it's just, the customs are different of the fact that in China, when a person has cancer, if the people that are taking care of that person, they're like their proxy or whatever, you don't have to tell them. Like it's the doctors don't necessarily tell you. And it's a weird, like almost a custom where I was always left wondering, did the grandma, I think kind of knew.
She kind of knew.
But it's like a weird game. And the Awkwafina's character, the struggle she goes through is she can't handle, she doesn't understand because she's American.
She's American. She's like, this would be illegal.
And here's the fascinating thing, and I'll just share this, is that several years ago, my father passed away of cancer. And one of the things was, as he was going through this, he didn't want his mother. I mentioned my grandmother was going to be 100. Oh, right. He didn't want her to know. And that was a little bit of a struggle for some of the family members
right.
who felt that she should know. And it really was this question as to why. His thought was, why am I worrying somebody who, you know, was in her 90s or yeah. just about 90 at the time, I think, when he ended up dying. And why are we putting that stress and burden on her? There's nothing she can do.
Right.
And he wanted to be able, when he had conversations, she knew he'd been sick and stuff, and she didn't. It was like the similar thing with the farewell.
Right.
Is she knew something may have been up, but when he had those conversations with her, he could have conversations with her that were anything but his right. cancer battle.
Right.
He had one person that he could just have normal, like whatever conversations he had with her, without it all being about his disease that he was battling.
Right. Because, and for her, that would just make her miserable. But you're right. Also, it gives him a place that isn't about that when everything else is about that.
And ultimately, it was about him, you know, it wasn't yeah. about her. And that was right, the thing right. when people like, what is his whole thing is, what is she going to do with that information that she has to yeah. know? At the time, she did, once it was to the end.
Yeah, yeah. Well, at the very end, sure. But it's like in The Farewell, what is she going to do with that information?
When I see a movie like this, right, it's that there's different reactions. Again, what is more entertaining when we talk about the best of the year? I look back and say, well, what did this movie give me? And it yeah. gave me a lot to think about.
Yep.
More than I get from a lot of movies. It really made me think about stuff in my life. And that's where I give the movie such high marks, and why it will, you know, unless I see a whole bunch of movies in the next few months, it will definitely be in my top 10.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's not like a brilliant masterwork of cinema the way The Irishman is. But not every movie has to be that in order to be really successful, I think. And I think that's important to point out that really, and I think what you're saying, and I tend to agree with this, that if you see the movie and you walk out of it changed somehow.
Yeah.
If it's altered your view, gotten you to think, gotten you to ask questions, gotten you to feel, then it's done something successful in it, and it's worth the accolades.
Yeah, and again, when you had said, you know, a great film to watch in the holidays, that is a movie that, again, if you're at least 10 years old or up,
yeah.
if you put this movie on and someone watches it, I challenge to find the person that thought this movie was horrible. Like, I mean, maybe they don't love it,
yeah.
but I mean, I you'd have to be a Grinch to not.
You would
like
have
this
to be
movie.
A Grinch. Yeah. Yeah. I did. I actually watched it with my wife. I didn't see it alone.
And what did she think? Did she like it too?
She liked it too. She felt very similar to the way I felt. Yeah.
Well, you know, you had some movies that you were saying, well, should we watch this or that? And I thought
yeah.
that because a hour and 40 time frame, it's, you
yes.
know, you can watch it. And I just thought she'd enjoy that.
Yeah. And yeah, she totally did. And yeah, now I want to get my parents to see it.
Yeah, and lots of luck if I'm never going to get my mom and her boyfriend to see it. But
no, my parents would love this. My parents would love it. Yeah.
And it was like Parasite. Like in 2 minutes, the subtitles, you forget that you're even
yeah,
watching
exactly.
them.
Yeah, totally. There's even a few English lines in this movie.
Yeah, and that yeah. and then what it also helps is that what Awkwafina's character is great is this whole, you know, the whole Beijing experience, she
yeah.
goes in and she is the audience. Like, this is foreign. This is weird. She
yes.
speaks some Chinese, but it's pretty poor, I guess.
Yep. Yeah, that's what they say, yeah.
And but so you feel like you're the fish out of water like her, so you can get into that experience because her character is finding it so weird and bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting in terms of how it situates itself culturally. It's not just... Yeah, in terms of the American and Chinese cultures coming together, it's designed in a way, well, I don't know. I guess what it is it's showing us Chinese culture, but in a way that doesn't feel exoticizing the
yes.
way it would be if it was a white main character who would say married into this family or
right.
something.
Right, right.
Yeah, so it didn't feel like there was, it didn't feel pandering, it didn't, yeah. It was done with great respect And you're right. She's a good surrogate for the audience.
I also like, her father.
Yes.
That's an actor. I don't know his name, but he has been in countless TV shows. And he's always playing the heavy. He's always the Chinese heavy.
He is always the Chinese heavy.
He was in like a season of 24. He was the Chinese president.
Yes.
And, but so what a treat for him to get to play this comic performance. Like it's a drama. And I thought it just reminds us that you're so often in our world of entertainment that Asian actors are marginalized into certain roles. And here's a guy who clearly has a lot more gifts, and this film gives him a chance to be a real character, a real person.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy – I mean, there isn't a single person in the cast that I didn't just love. So.
Oh, no. The performances are just fabulous all the way around. But he's particularly good. And I recognized him instantly too. He plays the heavy, but in here he brings so many different layers to his performance. And you realize, this guy's a great actor. It's just Hollywood hasn't known what to do with him.
Yeah, so I'm glad you got to see it, and I'm glad we finally got to talk about it. And The Farewell, go see it, everybody. And now, of course, we're going to talk about Paul Thomas Anderson, right? No, we don't. we ran out of time for Paul Thomas Anderson again. Something always stops us.
Something always stops us. I guess we'll become a running gag.
I hope not, because I really do want to talk about Paul Thomas Anderson. We'll get there one of these days.
Yeah, and one of these days I'll talk about Samara Weaving. But
Samara Weaving, your new femme fatale, and and one of these days we'll have Joel Petroikas on the show. You'll get to that email. Yep.
We'll get to that.
And Roma, we'll do a whole episode.
We're going to do a whole episode on Roma.
Imagine what you might think about Roma when you finally get to watch that.
I know, I'm excited about it now.
In a couple of years maybe you'll watch it.
Well, once the hype dies down.
Well, it's getting a Criterion release. I think that's telling.
Okay. Yeah, that is telling.
Yeah, and they did that also with the movie, the black and white movie that we liked so much from last year.
Cold War.
Cold War, Criterion. And so it's kind of a stamp of approval that if your movie, even if it was a streamer, it was that good, Criterion will get to do a release. All right.
Oh, that's cool.
All right, well, hopefully I will talk to you again before the holidays roll around. And
I hope so.
All right. Hey, everyone. Stay safe and go see some stuff, whether it's streaming or otherwise.
Bye-bye.
Bye.